shot, hitting the pot of marbles straight on, and nothing much happened. The pot just opened up a little, but not one marble went outside of the circle, and so my turn was over. "Now watch me," said my big brother, and I watched him select the marble he was going to use as his shooter. And he didn't select the prettiest marble like I had done. No, instead he took several and weighed each one up and down in his hand, feeling each marble very carefully with his fingers and thumb. "You see," he said, "I want the heaviest marble I can find that's still a normal size marble. And also I don't want a real smooth-feeling marble, because then it's too easy for that marble to keep slipping out between my thumb and finger when I go to shoot." I listened very carefully. None of this had ever entered my mind. "I want an older-feeling marble," he said, "like a cowboy always wants an older, experienced horse when he goes out on trail, or a baseball pitcher who feels the stitches of a baseball real carefully before he throws." "Wow," I said, "this is so exciting." A whole new world was opening up for me. "Yes, learning can be exciting," said my brother. "And now watch. I don't shoot at the pot of marbles. I shoot at this lone marble that's over here all by itself, so I can knock it all the way out of the pot. That ensures me that I'll get another shot." Well, lo and behold, my big brother Joseph cleaned out the whole pot. I mean, he shot out every damn marble in the circle. He was that great. No, he had to be better than great. He was the greatest shooter I'd ever seen. I now know why he had the nickname of Chaba Boy, Champion Boy. "And now listen to me," he said. "I was never that good of a shooter until Mike Acuña taught me how to shoot, and I practiced for hours and hours." "Then can you teach me how to shoot as good as you?" I asked, all excited. "You weren't listening. That's not what I said. I said that Mike Acuña taught me how to shoot, but then I added that I practiced for hours and hours all by myself."
"Oh, then can you teach me how to do it?"
"Of course, that's the easy part. The practicing is what's tough. And while you practice, you don't play marbles at school."
"Why not?"
"Because it will interfere with you concentrating on getting better. For 2 weeks, all you do is practice at home alone, without telling anyone. And at school, you don't play. Instead, you watch this boy Gus and the others play. You study their every move, memorizing their different styles, learning a little here and there from every player, and you tell no one what you're doing. Understand?"
"Okay," I said.
My heart was pounding. I was so excited I could have popped.
"I understand."
"Good. Now, first things first," continued my brother. "And so the first thing you learn is how to set the game up in your favor, or at least make it even. The second thing you learn is how to select your shooter. And now, the third thing that you must learn to do is how to hold your shooter. You see, some guys like to hold their shooters fist down, all knuckles to the dirt, like this. Others like their hand rolled over, palm up. Then there are a couple of real fancy ways, up high with your fingers spread out. Myself, I learned to keep it simple so I could concentrate on the playing. So, if I'm first shooter, I take a double handstand up high on my first shot so I can shoot downward to break up the pot. But then, after my first shot, I go into the traditional old-fashioned palm-up, big knuckle anchored in the dirt position. Are you getting all of this?"
"Yes,"
I said, nodding up and down. My God, and all I'd done was come into my brother's room to look through his stuff for his big bag of marbles. I'd never dreamed that there was all this thinking to playing marbles.
"Good," said my brother.
"I'm glad that you're finding this interesting, because being able to not just hear, but really listen, is what Papa always says is the beginning of all learning. And to learn is to be able to make distinctions. Now, are you ready for the big one, the secret that will make you a winner?" he asked.
"Yes, I'm ready,"
I said, feeling all excited. His face changed, and he put his hand on his forehead.
"What is it?"
I asked, suddenly seeing that my brother wasn't looking very well.
"Oh, I don't know. I've just been a little tired lately," he said. "But now listen,
This is the secret to winning, and this secret you must never tell anyone until you retire from the game, or you want to pass it on to your brother or sister. Sister, girls don't play marbles, I said, laughing. In the barrio, some girls did. Not too many, but the one or two who did, they were better than most of us guys.
Really?
Yes. Now listen closely, because this secret is actually done before you even start to play. And yet the whole outcome of your future is based on this secret. And Papa says the same thing is true in poker, dice, business, in all games of life there's a secret, and it's always very simple.
Well, what is it?
I asked. Are you listening? He said.
Yes, I said. I'm listening, damn it!
If you're the first shooter, you make sure that not all the marbles are put together real tight, he said.
What? That's it?
I said.
Yes,
he said.
That's it.
But, Mundo, but means you weren't listening, said my brother, just as our father always did when we used the word but. I could see that something was really hurting my brother.
Now, let's try again.
If you're the first shooter, you make sure that when everyone puts their marble in the circle, two or three of the marbles are a little bit away from the rest of the pot. Then these loose ones are the ones that you shoot into, and from an angle. Because when you hit those loose marbles from an angle, they'll scatter away from the pot, and most often one or two will go out of the circle. But if they're all in real tight, it's like hitting a brick wall for the first shooter.
But Jose, I said, how will I ever know if I'm going to be the first shooter, since we always put our marbles in the pot before we lag our shooters to see who gets to go first?
Just change your procedure of doing this, too, he said. Make a side bet of one marble each for whoever wins the lagging, so that the lagging will become a betting game on its own, and you can then say that you want to do it first.
I can do that? Just tell people that we lag first, then we put in our marble afterward?
You can with the vote, he said, and by being the one who made the suggestion of what to vote on.
Really?
Yes.
You see, once you get a vote going and people feel that you're a fair person, then they'll go along with almost all your other suggestions.
They will?
Oh, wow! Then the guy who brings up the idea on what to vote on is way ahead of the game in getting what he wants.
Exactly.
And Papa taught you this?
Yes, and he learned a lot of this from
his mother, I said.
Our dad was always talking about his mother, Doña Margarita. Exactly, from his mother, and also from that man named Duell up in Montana. Our father always spoke about Duell, too.
Then Papa used to play marbles? I said.
My brother laughed.
No, Papa never played marbles, he said.
But one day when Papa saw me looking sad in the barrio, he asked me what was the trouble, and I told him that I'd lost all my marbles. He asked me who had beat me out of them. I told him Mike Acuña. He told me to go and get Mike. I went and got Mike, thinking that Papa was going to tell Mike to give me my marbles back, because he was way older than me. But Papa surprised me. Instead, he asked Mike if he'd like to make 50 cents a day teaching me how to play marbles.
Our dad did what? You mean that he paid someone good money to teach you how to play a kid's game?
Papa always explained to me that there is no such thing as a kid's game, that there are only games with which kids are learning the facts of life, but it's the parents that are so tapados, so blind and constipated, that they can't see what these games are really all about. I'll never forget that day. Mike's eyes became larger than a rabbit's because he'd thought that he was going to get in trouble, but instead he was being offered a paying job, and 50 cents a day was a lot of money back then.
It will take me a week, said Mike.
Make it 2 weeks, said our father, and I'll pay you $5 up front to get started. But you tell no one, understand, or I won't pay you the rest of the money. And you teach him here in the backyard, so I can keep an eye on both of you. After those 2 weeks, I went from being one of the worst players in all the barrio to one of the best.
I'll be damned, I said.
Don't you use that word again, said my brother. You've said it, I think, 3 times since we've been talking.
What word?
Damn.
I have?
Yes, and you don't want to say that word towards anyone, and especially not towards yourself.
Our mamá grande, Doña Margarita,
papá's mamá, would never allow us to use that word. Instead, she'd have us bless ourselves and bless everyone else too, explaining to us that this was our power, when we humans all lived in God's blessings.
You knew her? I asked.
Of course, Tencha and I grew up with her.
I never got to meet papá's mamá, I said.
Yes, we all know that, because she died 2 years to the day, to the hour before you were born, which means in some Indian ways of thinking that you are her.
Me? I'm our mamá grande?
Why not? We're all little pieces of somebody from our ancestry.
You mean like pieces of dust from stars, like mamá's mamá used to tell me?
That, and also from our antepasado, our ancestry. Why do you think papá is so smart? He's lived life's many trials. He's his grandfather, Don Pio, his mother's father. Don't you always hear papá saying that blood knows blood and usually jumps one generation?
Yes, but I never knew that he really meant what he was saying.
Mundo, you start paying closer attention to our mamá and papá. They didn't get this far in life because their eyes are closed. I nodded. I'd never had a conversation like this before with my brother Joseph. I now wondered if his blood had jumped too, and he was then, in fact, our own Uncle José the Great, our papá's older brother who'd almost single-handedly saved all of Los Altos de Jalisco from the Mexican Revolution. All that afternoon, I practiced my shooting, and I also tried to get better at selecting my shooter, not for prettiness, but for weight and feel. Finally, I found that if I closed my eyes, I could feel better than if I kept my eyes open. And also, I found out that when I finally found a good, heavy shooter that was a little bit rough and fit real good between my thumb and index finger, I could then put extra pressure on that marble without it slipping out of my hand. Suddenly, I was shooting way harder and straighter than I'd ever shot in all my life. My God, when I was finally called in for dinner, I didn't want to go inside. Learning was so much blessed fun when it made sense. All that night, I dreamed of playing marbles. Something really wonderful had happened to me. It was like before, I hadn't known enough so I could think or dream about playing marbles. But now that my brother had taught me all this stuff, I couldn't turn off my brain, especially when I went to sleep. It was like all night long I'd have that humming, that purring going on at the base of the back of my head, going back and forth between my 2 ears. In the morning, I awoke feeling like I had really slept in the arms of Papito Dios all night long. This day, for the first time in my life, I was all excited to go to school. But then, getting there, I quickly remembered that I wasn't supposed to play for 2 weeks. The next 2 weeks were the longest of my life, as I practiced and practiced at home every afternoon, with my brother giving me pointers now and then. But he couldn't help me too much anymore. He'd made the junior varsity football team, and he was now staying late at school and working out with the team. And every night, I'd continue to have these wonderful dreams of playing great games of marbles, and I'd be really good. My daydreaming and my night dreaming had become one, just as my mamá grande had explained to me it had been for all people when we'd lived in the garden. At school, I'd watch Gus and the other guys play, and now, way different than before, I could see things going on that I'd never seen before. I was making distinctions, just as my brother had explained to me I would do as I learned more and more. Gus, I could now see, wasn't just good at breaking up the pot with his big boulder. He was also probably the best shooter of the whole school once he switched over to his regular size marble. My dreams of playing marbles continued, and then one night, my 2 dead grandmothers and my old dog Sam, who'd got run over by a car, saving my life, came to me in my sleep. and Sam licked my face, and my two Mama Grandes took me hand in hand and walked me across the heavens. Then we stepped into a star that was blue and green with a touch of red, and miraculously we were shooting across the greatest star-studded marble game ever played. This was great. Instantly I understood that playing marbles was no kid's game at all. Playing marbles was teaching me all about God's garden, just as my grandmother had taught me when we'd planted a vegetable garden next to her little casita. Our papa had been absolutely right when he'd told my brother Joseph that there was no such thing as kids' games. That morning I awoke, feeling that little purr humming behind both of my ears, and I knew that all last night I'd truly slept in the holy arms of Papito Dios, just as mi mamá told me I would do when she'd sing me to sleep each night, cuckooing me with the song of the turtle dove. The next day I went to school with a strength and confidence I'd never felt before. And when I watched the guys playing marbles at recess, I could now see even more things that I'd never seen before. And yeah, sure, I knew that I wasn't supposed to play yet, but this didn't mean that I couldn't help to organize a vote. I mean, Gus was just beating the pants off everyone because of the great big boulder that he used for busting up the pot of marbles, and everyone assumed that this was the way it was, and so we couldn't do anything about it. I took a few guys aside and told them that I'd found out that switchies weren't allowed across the lagoon over in Carlsbad. "So," said one guy. I could see that they hadn't understood what I'd said. "No switchies," I said, "means that Gus can't change from his boulder to a regular size marble after his first shot. That if he starts with a boulder, then he has to continue with a boulder, and no one is a very good shot with a boulder on singles, not even Gus." Their eyes suddenly lit up. They loved it. Hell, we didn't even have to take a vote on it. They immediately just went over and told Gus that switchies weren't allowed in California. Well, I'd never said this, but it worked. Because no matter how mad Gus got about this, all the guys stuck together and said that they wouldn't play with him anymore if he continued switching from his big boulder to his regular shooter after his first shot. Finally, Gus saw that his goose was cooked, and so he calmed down and agreed to the new rule, but not until he'd cussed out all of us chicken liver sissy baby Californians. But still, even with this rule, Gus kept winning most of the marbles. He was just a damn good, I mean, blessed good shooter. And at home, I kept practicing and practicing, and I could see that I was really getting pretty good. But now my brother wasn't helping me at all anymore. No, he was coming home after football practice, and immediately going to bed, he was feeling so tired. Finally, my 2 weeks were over, and I could hardly sleep that night. I was so excited to get to school so I could start playing. "Dear God," I prayed that night, "please help me to play well tomorrow, and also help me to remember everything that my brother has taught me. Because, you see, God, my brother isn't feeling well enough to help me anymore." "Good night, Papito," I added. "See you in the morning. And please help my brother Jose to get well." That night, I didn't dream of playing games of marbles. No. Instead, I dreamed of all the things my brother had instructed me. "You're going to have to be very careful to not become a show-off or make fun of people who don't know how to play as well as you. In fact, Papa told me that Duel, his friend from Montana, explained to him that if you get cocky or show off too much, people will turn against you and then you'll have no one to play with." "So what do you do?" Jose then asked me. "I let the guys win back some marbles, especially towards the end of the day," I said in my dream to my brother, as he'd instructed me to do, "so that then they'll go home feeling good and have the hopes of beating me tomorrow." "Exactly," said my brother. "And you never brag about how good you are like Gus does, because a real king doesn't need to tell anyone that he's the king. In fact, a real king keeps his reign as much of a secret as he can." "Good luck," added my brother. "And always remember that our father says that luck is a beautiful woman who needs constant courtship." Waking up that morning, I was so excited to get to school so I could maybe pick up a game or two before school started that I even forgot to wait for Whataking so we could eat our cream puffs together. I was into my second game of marbles, beating the pants off everyone, when Whataking came up on his Schwinn bike. He was mad as hell and said that he'd waited for me at the corner of California and Stewart Streets for a long time. Then he'd gone to my house to see if I was sick, and our dog had almost bit him. He told me that he was never going to bring another cream puff for me as long as he lived. I told him that I was sorry, but I couldn't talk right now because at that moment I was winning. He left in a huff, and I continued playing. It was so exciting for me to win for a change that, boy oh boy, this tasted even better than a blessed cream puff. All that week I avoided playing against Gus, figuring that I had better do as my brother had told me to do, and that was to get quite a few wins under my belt before I played against the best kid on the block. On Friday, since I'd been winning every day, I figured that I was ready to go head-to-head with Gus. Also, all week he'd been making chicken sounds at me, calling me a sissy, and I was sick of it. "Okay," I said to Gus on Friday morning as soon as we got to school, "I'll play you today, but only head-to-head, with no one else in the game with us." My brother had also suggested that I do it this way so I'd be able to keep my full concentration like I did at practice. "But maybe Gus won't go for it," I'd said to my brother. "Don't worry, being a show-off, he'll jump at it," my brother had reassured me. "Now you're cooking," said Gus excitedly, just as I'd been told that he would do. "Mano a mano, I like it. We'll all have us a regular Mexican standoff." Well, I liked the expression mano a mano, but I'd never liked the expression Mexican standoff. "Look," I said, "just the two of us and no switchies." "You two," he yelled. "Hell, I'd thought you were a real cowboy. I didn't think you were a chicken-liver little girl like these other damn sissy Californians." I closed my eyes, breathed, then reopened them. "I am a real cowboy," I said. "That's why I'm a vaquero. And being a vaquero means..." "I knows what a vaquero means," said Gus. "I wasn't born yesterday. It all means cowboy in Mexican." "Yes. And the cowboys learned everything that they know from the vaqueros. The word rodeo itself comes from Mexico. And for you to call me a girl is good because..." "Yeah, I know," he said. "I ain't an ignorant Californian. I'm a Texan. And we Texans all knows that our cowboy words and stuff originally came from the vaqueros. But then we Texans took over after the Alamo and improved on the whole thing so much that that's why we can now out-rodeo any damn Mexican chili belly ever born," he added with pride. I felt like I'd been slapped across the face, because this wasn't true. I'd seen our top hand Nicolas outride all of the American cowboys last 4th of July once again. "No, not improved," I said. "Made mean in wanting to break the horse instead of amansar the horse, which means..." "Who cares what it means," said Gus. "Let's just stop jawing and see who's top dog, even with your little girl chicken stuff of no switchies." I was so mad that I was trembling. So when we lagged, I wasn't that careful, and he easily won and got to be first shooter. But still, I knew enough about what I was doing that I made sure that all the marbles were in really tight together in the center, so he'd hit a brick wall with his first shot. And it worked, just as I'd been taught that it would. Now it was my turn, and I'd calmed myself down enough so I could shoot. I went after an easy lone marble like my brother had taught me to do. Nothing fancy. I didn't try to go after the two marbles that were real close together, so I could maybe knock out two at the same time. No, I carefully went to work like my brother had taught me to do, marble by marble, concentrating completely on my shooting just as I'd done at practice, and before I'd even realized it, oh my Lord God, I'd cleaned out the whole damn, blessed pot. I was even better than I'd thought. But Gus was far from giving up. and this time we didn't have to lag to see who went first. Now, since it was just the two of us playing, I got to go first. A whole bunch of kids gathered around to watch us play, even some girls. But I didn't let any of this distract me, and I made sure that three little marbles were just a little tiny bit away from the rest of the pot. Then I acted like I was going to shoot from the other side of the circle, like my brother had taught me to do. So when I finally came back around to take my angle shot on the three loose marbles, it would look like I'd just seen these loose ones by chance and hadn't deliberately set them up like this in the first place. My God, it worked like a charm, and I cleaned out the whole pot again. By now, half of the school was watching. In fact, when the recess bell rang, not one of us ever heard it. We were all so excited. Our teachers finally had to come out to get us. "That was just damn luck," said Gus to me as we went back to our classroom. "Just wait till after school. I'll get you. I know you're not that good. Hell, I'm the one who taught you how to play." I nodded, saying nothing. But boy, was I ever tempted to tell Gus that I'd been practicing at home for weeks and being coached by a player far better than him. I said nothing, not then and not ever. This I'd also been taught. "Keep your cards close to your chest," my father always told us. That afternoon after school, Gus and I got together, and we decided to do our shootout at the far end of the schoolyard under the big eucalyptus trees that grew along Stewart Street on the east side of our school. Here we cleaned out a good-sized piece of ground by dragging our shoes across it and wiping it all clean. Then we used fallen branches to sweep it smooth. About a dozen kids stayed after school to watch us play. Two were girls, and one was real pretty. But I was learning that pretty wasn't the best way for you to pick a girl or a marble. No, you closed your eyes and got a feel for the girl or marble. Closing my eyes, then reopening them, I could now see the second girl was real cute and had eyes as beautiful and kind-looking as a goat's, which of course was good, because this meant she was at peace with her animal spirit. "All right," said Gus. He'd just finished drawing the circle. "Let's play." Looking at the circle, I knew that something was different, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it because everything looked so different out here underneath these huge eucalyptus trees. Then it hit me. Hell, Gus had drawn the circle way bigger than the circles that we normally used on the school grounds under the pepper trees where we parked our bikes. A chill went up and down my spine. I could now see that Gus had also got some adult coaching on how to play marbles. He'd just changed the whole game on me, and I could see why. He was bigger than most of us kids, and stronger too, and so a larger pot would work in his favor.
"Pock, pock, pock,"
he said, making those chicken sounds at me when he saw how I was studying the size of the circle. "Come on, let's just play. Stop being a chicken. I figure that you and I are the best damn shots in the whole third grade, and I already gave you no switchies. So let's stop all this baby girl stuff and play like we do back in Texas, a big-ass old circle, and we put in 50 marbles each." 50, I said, taken aback by this. "I don't think I even have that many." My brother had also told me to never bring all my marbles to school, only bring 30 or 40 marbles at a time so no one would ever know how much I was winning. "The guys who bring all their marbles to school," said my brother, "showing everyone how much they've won, are fools, and fools always end up out-fooling themselves." "All right," said Gus, showing everyone his huge bag of marbles. "I'll just match whatever you got." My heart was pounding, and I wanted to say no and tell him that I'd only put in 10 marbles like we normally did, but he started in with his chicken calls once again.
"Bok, bok, 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 bok,"
he said. "Come on, I'll match everything you have and even put in an extra 5 marbles. Hell, I'll make it 10. I licked my lips. This was really tempting, but still, I just knew that this wasn't right, because Gus was now moving me from our regular game into a game that I knew nothing about. Still, with the thought of those 10 extra marbles, I finally cracked and said, "Okay." Hearing this, Gus now moved in with the confidence of a panther going after a deer, and he beat me out of almost all of my marbles in 1, 2, 3, because he wasn't just bigger and stronger than me, but also knew how to work the marbles close to the edge by shooting into 3 or 4 marbles at a time. That afternoon, everyone applauded Gus, including the 2 girls. But then the girl with the large, kind goat eyes actually came close to me.
"You did really well, too," she said in a kind tone of voice. My whole world stopped. My God, this was the first girl who'd ever spoken to me in all of my years of going to school. Her name was Nancy, and she had long, dark brown hair. She offered me a piece of bubble gum, and when I took off the wrapper, she took the funnies from me that were attached to the inside wrapper, and she read them and laughed. I could see she was really smart, because she'd understood the joke, which I never did. Just then, a breeze picked up, and I glanced up at the huge old eucalyptus tree above us, and I could see that he was smiling. I smiled back, thanking the tree. "Always remember," mi mamá grande had explained to me many times, "the whole spirit world is always with us wherever we go, if we just have the ojo, eyes, to see from our hearts, and the oreja, ears, to hear from our soul." That afternoon, Gus went home telling everyone how he was still the champ and would always be the champ. And that night, I felt kind of stupid, but still I explained to my brother what had happened. To my surprise, Joseph didn't get mad at me. No, instead, he said, "I'm glad that Gus beat you."
"But why are you glad that he beat me?" I asked, feeling all confused that my own brother would say this to me.
"Because you were getting cocky," he said.
"No, I wasn't," I said quickly.
"Look," he said, sitting up in bed, "if you hadn't won all week long, would you have ever agreed to play in that larger circle?"
"Well, no, I guess not."
"Exactly. You agreed to do it because you were beginning to think that you were so good that you didn't need to stick to basics. Papa always says that the easiest guys to con are other con artists, because cons are always looking for shortcuts and easy ways in life. Now, just let me get out of bed, and you show me how large that circle was."
I could see that it was hard for my brother to get himself out of bed.
"He was smart, you know, to move you from your game to his game. I bet he's had coaching."
"Yeah," I said, "I thought of that too."
"Good. I'm glad you're thinking. Papa always says that knowing how to think and keep his eyes open is what saved him and his mother and sisters time and again during the revolution." Going out the back door of our old ranch house, we crossed the field to our new home, which was almost done. My brother had to stop several times to catch his breath. And yet, when we'd go to the Army-Navy Academy to watch him play football, we'd see them hand him the ball and he'd go running real fast, knocking people out of the way. In the dirt in front of our new 2-story home, I drew a circle about the same size that Gus had used to beat me. I couldn't believe it. My brother now quickly showed me how to work a big circle. In a large circle, unlike a smaller circle, you shot into little groups of marbles that were near the edge, not the singles, which you could miss because of the greater distance. And I could see that this was exactly what Gus had done. Then, I'll never forget, going back to our old home that afternoon, my brother went over to the drawer where he kept his socks all neatly put away, military style, one halfway inside of the other, and he brought out a black sock and turned it upside down on the bed. And here, before my eyes, I saw the prettiest, clear-colored, cherry-red marble that I'd ever seen roll out of the sock. It was a normal-size marble, too, but just a little bit larger. "Back in the barrio, this was my main shooter," said my brother. "But I didn't use her every day. I used Big Cherry only for special games." "She's yours," he added.
"Mine?"
"Yes, yours. And with this marble, I want you to beat Gus. Big Cherry has been in many battles. You look at her carefully and you'll see she's pretty marked up. Once, blessed Vato sneaked in a steely on me in a game of chasies. Don't ever play chasies with her. She's your thoroughbred. You don't use her for roping or bulldogging. Go on, pick her up."
But I couldn't. All I could do was stare at this most beautiful marble that I'd ever seen. "Take her," he said again. Finally, I reached down and picked Big Cherry off the bed, holding her between my thumb and index finger so I could hold her up to the light. "But this marble is so beautiful, and I thought you told me that a shooter shouldn't be beautiful," I said. "There are exceptions to every rule," said my brother. "And besides, feel her weight and surface." "My God, you're right. She's heavy, and she's not too smooth either."
"Exactly. So it's okay if a shooter happens to be beautiful. The main thing is that you didn't pick her for her beauty any more than Papa chose Mama because of her great beauty."
"Mama's beautiful?" I asked.
"Are you blind?" said my brother. "Don't you see how men and women are always looking at our mother everywhere she goes? Our mother is more beautiful than any movie star you'll ever see. And yet, this isn't why Papa chose her. He chose her, he's told us 1,000 times, because when he first saw her, she was in line to go into the dance hall over in Carlos Malo with her brother and sister. And when a fight broke out, she didn't get excited and enjoy it like her sister and the other women. No, she and her brother moved away, wanting no part of it. And so, by seeing this, Papa knew that she was a woman of high intelligence, respect, and responsibility, a person that he could trust with his life. And trust, remember, is the foundation of all love, Papa says.
I see, I said. Then our Mama is beautiful, I said,
big tears coming to my eyes.
And Papa, he's smart, because he knew how to choose a wife. And knowing how to choose a wife is the most important thing that any man can do in all of his life.
Exactly, said my brother. Because from our wives come our children, I said, as I'd heard our dad tell us 1,000 times. And our children inherit their instinct for survival from the women. My brother smiled. I see that you've been listening. Good, he added. I couldn't stop crying. All these years since I'd started school, I'd thought that my mother was ugly and my father was a fool. My brother took me in his arms and held me a long time, and it felt so good. The following week, I went to school with the power inside of my heart corazón that was bursting, and I beat the hell out of everyone at recess, including Gus, with our regular-sized circles. And then, after school, when we went out once more to play under the huge old eucalyptus trees, I brought out my brother's big cherry, and I beat the crap out of Gus with his big circle, too. And when he said that Big Cherry was the size of a boulder and I couldn't use her unless he could do switchies, I almost said, "Sure, do your switchies, I'll beat you anyway." But I didn't, because I could now see that this would be cocky talk. I put Big Cherry away. And still I was able to beat him with my regular shooter. Something had happened to me. It was like I just couldn't do anything wrong. But then I remembered that my brother told me that our dad had learned from Duel up in Montana to always let the other guys win back a little bit of their money at the end of the night of poker playing, so they'd want to play with you again the next day. I did this. I missed a shot, pretended like I was all upset with myself, and Gus got excited and came in and shot the hell out of the last few marbles in the pot. Then he screamed with joy and went home that afternoon telling everyone that he was still the real champ because he'd beat me in the end and he also had a hell of a lot more marbles than me. By the end of that week, it was easy to see who was the new marble champion of our whole third grade if they just looked past how many marbles we brought to school. But I said nothing. In fact, I could now see that my brother had been very wise to tell me that a real king kept his reign a secret. I'd listened, practiced, learned, kicked ass, and I'd also found out that my mother was beautiful and my father was smart, and that maybe I wasn't very good in the classroom, but still I, un Mexicano, could think, organize a vote, and kick ass at recess. I couldn't stop crying. I was so happy. I was el king. Chapter 9.
Knowing that I was king felt pretty blessed good. And now that I didn't feel terrified of going to school, I quit wetting my bed. My days at school began to be magical, and not just at recess either. In the classroom, I could now see that there was value in some of the things that were being taught to us. It was at this time that we were taught something called multiplication and division. Some kids were having real difficulty catching on, but for me, on the other hand, I was able to catch on how to do my multiplication and division right away. Different than with the alphabet and reading, numbers made a lot of sense to me. With adding and subtracting, I could figure out how many bales of hay we got off a hillside, or how many marbles I had. And with multiplication, I could line up my marbles in lines of tens, then just multiply by 10 how many lines I had. This was really great. It saved me a whole lot of time, especially now that I had well over 400 marbles. Also, different than with the alphabet, in math you had only 9 numbers that you had to memorize, unless you counted in the zero. And counting in the zero made a lot of sense to me too, because after you got to 9, then all you had to do was just put down a 1 like you'd done at the beginning and add a 0 to that 1, and now you had 10, which was like a whole new start until you got all the way up to 19. Then all you had to put down was a 2. Which made sense, since 2 came after 1, and now you'd put a 0 behind this 2, and you had yourself 20. I loved this kind of clear, easy thinking. It made a lot more sense to me than that blessed alphabet, where you had to memorize 26 letters, then put those letters into bunches with no rhyme or reason to make up different words. Like the word READ itself was sometimes read, and then other times read. This pissed me off. Reading and writing were a pain in the ass. Why couldn't we have a lot less letters, and maybe even a 0 letter to bunch things up with? Because adding and subtracting made so much sense to me, I quickly learned how to add and subtract 2 or 3 columns in my head. None of the other kids could do it. Suddenly, I was smart. I began to think that my days as a slow learner were behind me. And no one at this new school was ever going to find out that I'd been called stupid at the other school across town. One day, during reading, our teacher asked who would like to stand up and read aloud, just as our teachers had done in the 1st and 2nd grades. My God, the terror that shot through my whole body made me sick. And suddenly, I wasn't king anymore. Hell, I wasn't even a 3rd grader. No, I was a heart-pounding kindergarten baby born in the gravy and ready to pee in my pants again. I'll never forget as long as I live how our teacher looked around the class to see whom to call on first, and when her eyes came towards my section of the classroom, I closed my eyes and said a quick little prayer. "Please, Lord God," I said, "don't let her call on me, because if she does, I'm sure to pee in my pants." Then I heard her laugh. And so I opened up my eyes, and miracle of miracles, God the Merciful saved me, because instead of needing to pick someone to read, all these hands went flying up, especially the hands of girls wanting to read. "Thank God for all girls," I said to God, and I thought that my prayers were answered and all my problems were over forever and ever, and our teacher was only going to ask who wanted to read for the rest of the year. After all, she was right to do this, I figured. We weren't 1st or 2nd graders anymore. No, we were big 3rd graders, 3 years away from being babies born in the gravy. So reading should be voluntary. But then one day she asked, "Well, who hasn't had a chance to read so far?" And she glanced all around the classroom, and once again her eyes, oh my Lord God, came to rest on me. I got so scared that I thought of bolting from the classroom, jumping on my Schwinn and pedaling for home as fast as I could. But then, thank God, the bell rang and it was lunchtime. Quickly, I tried to figure out what to do. I only had so much time, and I knew there were quite a few of us who hadn't read yet, because it always seemed to be the same 6 girls and a couple of boys who always raised their hands wanting to read. I went around and very quickly asked the different guys, who I thought hadn't read, if they'd read so far,
A couple of these guys immediately said that they hadn't. A few others wanted to know why I wanted to know. I didn't know what to say, because up to that point, everyone in my class assumed that I was one of the smartest and most capable of all us kids because of my marble shooting and how good I was in math. "Look," I said, suddenly remembering how my brother Joseph had explained to me that our dad had paid that Acuña kid to teach my brother how to play marbles. "I'll pay you each, well, a nickel if you put up your hand and tell our teacher that you haven't read yet." "You got a nickel?" asked one kid suspiciously. "Well, no, not right now, but I'll bring some tomorrow." "And how do we know that you'll keep your word?" "Because I promise," I said. "But everyone knows that Mexicans never keep their..." This kid never got to finish his words. I was on him like a swarm of flies on fresh shit, knocking him to the ground and hitting him as fast as I could. "Okay, okay," he yelled. "I'll do it, I'll do it." My heart wouldn't calm down. I wanted to keep hitting him. It was my first real fight. I could now see that all my other fights had just been wrestling matches. This one had been the real thing. I'd really wanted to hurt him, just like his words had hurt me. He'd never had a chance. I liked this. Never again would I let anyone say anything bad about me or my people. I'd knock the living hell out of them. And if they were bigger than me, then I'd go home and get myself some dynamite and blow them to smithereens. Suddenly, I remembered Ramon, my hero, and I wished that he'd been here to see me in action. I wondered what had happened to him. He'd been so smart and capable, but our teachers had never seen this. All they'd ever seen was a stupid, lying, no-good, sneaky Mexican. After lunch, we went back into the classroom, and when the teacher asked who hadn't read yet, my good friend, whom I'd just beaten up, glanced at me, then put up his hand real fast, and he read really well. Then another friend of mine raised his hand, too. At lunchtime, I'd made deals with four kids, but I'd only had to knock the hell out of one. And the next day, I brought a bunch of nickels in my pocket and paid off the four guys, even the guy whom I'd beaten up. But he didn't want my money. "Go on, take it," I said. "And no hurt feelings, just never insult me again." He nodded, taking the nickel. "I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't know you'd get so mad." "Well, now you know." "I didn't even know if you were really a Mexican. I thought all of the Mexicans lived across Oceanside in Pasole Town." I never heard the word pozole, which was a type of Mexican soup, pronounced the way this boy had said it. It sounded vulgar. Just like the word Mexican had sounded so dirty when that playground rooster female teacher had yelled it at us all through kindergarten. "The word is pozole," I said to him, "not pasole. That sounds ugly. And I want you to know that Mexicanos do keep their word. In fact, hombre de palabra, man of his word, is the highest praise you can give to any man, my father always tells us." "Okay," he said. "I didn't know." "Okay," I said, "but now you do know. And yes, I'm Mexican. Both of my parents came from Mexico." It was over. I could just feel it. Having beat this kid up so easily had opened up a whole new world of possibilities for me. Having worked on the ranch and needing to move pigs and calves and horses around all my life had made me strong and taught me how to maneuver in a way these city kids knew nothing about. It was almost the end of the year, and our teacher asked Gus and me and this one other kid to stay in the classroom during lunchtime because she needed to speak to us. Instantly, I knew what was going on. We were the three kids who always tried to avoid reading. But I'd seen Gus and this other kid read a couple of times, so I knew that they were a whole lot better than me. So when lunchtime came, I acted like I'd forgotten what our teacher said, and I got up and started going out with the other kids. Because once I was out the door, I already knew what I was going to do. I was going to jump on my Schwinn bike and pedal home as fast as I could and never come to school again. I'd hide in our big avocado orchards all day, or down in the swamp, then come home in the afternoon and pretend I'd been at school all day. But I didn't even make it out the door. Our teacher caught me. Her name was Mrs. Morlow, and she wasn't really mean like the other teachers that I'd had. In fact, I'd say that she was the first fair-minded teacher that I'd ever gotten. "Excuse me," she said, "but I think you forgot that I said I need to speak to you." There was nothing I could do. She'd caught me cold. Gus and the other kid were grinning. They'd been smart enough not to try to make a break for it. She asked Gus and the other boy to wait for her outside the classroom door, and they went out with the rest of the kids. Now I was alone with Mrs. Morlow. "I don't think that you've read for me all year, have you?" she said. I was looking down at the floor, studying the different squares of the tile-like flooring. I'd never realized until now that this was the exact same flooring that they used at Penny's. Remembering Penny's, I began to wonder if I needed any new clothes, or maybe, now that I was older, I should ask my parents to take me to Sears in Escondido. That's where my father had just bought some great new spurs. "Look," she said when I didn't reply, "I saw how quickly you were able to learn your multiplication and division, so I think that you probably just need a little help with your reading. Here, sit down with me," she said in a kind voice, "and let me see you read this page." I sat down. There was nothing else I could do. I took the book that she gave me, and immediately all these white rivers began running up and down the page between the words, and the words, they would just jump up off the page at me. I took in a big breath, held, and I tried to focus my vision to just one word at a time, and then move my eyes from the left side of the word to the right side of the word, as we'd been told to do in first and second grades. But it was really hard for me to hold on to the different letters, with all the ups and downs of short letters, long letters, and those other ones with the tails that hung down below the line. I was so scared to make a mistake and maybe say something in Spanish that I finally just began crying. "You can't read, can you?" she asked. "No, I can't," I said, wiping my tears. "How long has this been going on?"
"Since we first started reading."
"In first grade?"
"Yes."
"And no one noticed this before?"
"No, ma'am."
She looked at me for a long time, and I could see that her look wasn't mean, and she wasn't going to slap me on the head for not paying attention, like my first and second grade teachers used to do. I could hardly remember anything else about the second grade except our teacher, a woman, hitting us Mexican kids so hard and calling us stupid Mexicans that my ears still rang. But we hadn't even all been Mexicanos, and so we'd sometimes laugh when we'd see her hit the two local Indian kids who weren't Mexicans, because now, finally, someone else was getting it besides us vatos. This was democracy, Ramon told us, everyone getting hit equally.
"Look," she finally said in a kind voice, "I think that if you stay with me a few minutes after school every day, we can have you reading between now and the end of the year. Because, you see," she added, "if we don't have you reading at a third grade level by the end of the school year, you'll have to repeat the third grade again."
"Repeat?" I said.
"Yes. We'll have to hold you back a year."
I nodded. I understood. I was going to be roped, tied, and branded a stupid, slow learner for life if I didn't learn to read well in the next month and a half. She wrote out a note and told me to take it to my parents so that they'd be informed and know why I'd be getting home a little late every day. Then she told me to go outside and tell Gus to come in. When I went out, Gus gave me a great big grin like I'd never seen him give before.
"So we got busted, eh, partner?" he said. "But it ain't so bad. Hell, I've flunked before."
"You have?"
"Hell yeah, back in Texas. I flunked me one grade real good."
And saying this, he went in to see the teacher with a swagger like he was king of the world. Suddenly I wondered what the hell was going on. Ramon had been the smartest and most capable guy in our whole grade in thinking and figuring out things, and he'd been considered dumb too. And now Gus, he was also the smartest guy of all of us during recess, and he just said that he'd been flunked before. This didn't make any blessed sense to me at all. The smartest kids I knew were all considered stupid.
That night I took the note to my parents, and my mother read it and asked me what was going on.
I don't know, I said, lying. Tell me, what does the note say, Mama?
Your teacher says that you need help with your reading and that she's willing to stay after school and help you a little each day. She also says that you do very well with your arithmetic, so she thinks that you'll catch up by the end of the year.
Do you have trouble reading, mijito?
Asked my mother. My eyes filled with tears. I didn't know what to say. I didn't want my own mother to find out that I was stupid. She took me in her arms, and that night she sang to me an extra long time about God's turtle dove de amor that sings cuckoo-roo-cuckoo. I loved my mama so much. Nothing bad could ever happen to me when she held me in her large, warm arms. All that week, Gus and I and this other kid stayed after school, and our teacher tried to help us with our reading. Gus was actually pretty good at his reading, and so by the end of 2 weeks, he didn't have to stay after school anymore. By the third week, I could see that our teacher was getting short-tempered with the other kid and me. After about 30 minutes of helping us, she'd begin to look at the clock on the wall and get irritated with us. Then in the fourth week, I don't know what happened, but the other kid quit coming to school altogether, and I was now alone with Mrs. Morlow. And this was when she told me that my parents would have to come to school so she could speak with them in person. It was only 2 weeks until the end of school. That day I went home on my Schwinn bike, crying the whole way. I knew what was coming, and I'd tried to pay attention so hard and learn how to read, but I couldn't do it. All those letters just kept jumping around, making designs that made no sense to me. At home, I gave my parents the note my teacher had given me to give to them. Then we went to the school in my parents' new car. It was a great, big, long, navy blue Cadillac, the first Cadillac in all of Oceanside and Carlsbad after the war. Also, our new home was finished, and now my father and mother were going to downtown San Diego and ordering custom-made furniture from a great big fancy furniture store that had the biggest elevator I'd ever seen. I could see that my teacher almost shit in her pants, I mean dress, when she saw my father and mother drive up in their big car and get out all dressed up. I don't know what she'd been expecting, but here was my father dressed in tailor-made silver-gray western slacks, a beautiful handmade belt and buckle from Mexico, and his big cowboy hat with the fancy horsehair band. And my mother, she was dressed in her Sunday best, looking like a movie star. Myself, I was still in my school clothes that were the same ones that I used for working around the ranch. Nervously, Mrs. Morlow fixed her hair, then kept asking my parents to please sit down, until she realized that our third-grade furniture was too small for adults. Still, my father maneuvered his large, thick body into one of the little desk chairs. It was really funny seeing me papa in one of our desk chairs. My mother didn't even try. Calming down, my teacher finally told my parents the same thing that she'd told me, that I was smart at arithmetic, so she'd thought that I could catch up on my reading, but I hadn't been able to do it. Then she dropped the bomb. I'll be recommending that he repeat the third grade, she said. I watched my parents look at each other. My mother was the first to speak.
Does this mean that he'll be held back a year? Asked my mother.
Yes, said my teacher. I could see that she felt pretty terrible herself.
I see, said my mother.
And she now also tried to put her body into one of our small desk chairs as my father had. I could see that she was thinking and trying to understand the situation.
Are there any other children who are being